It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the security of future elections is in the spotlight following the release of the redacted Mueller report. We'll learn more about Russian cyber attacks during the 2016 campaign and what it could mean for 2020. First, if you were going to make a grilled cheese sandwich when you get home today, how would you do it? What kind of bread would you use? And what kind of cheese? Any onions, meat, tomatoes, other toppings? The possibilities are limitless. Our guest says a golden, buttery, crispy, gooey grilled cheese sandwich can add some cheer to an otherwise gray and dreary spring day, which we've had some of lately. And given that April is National Grilled Cheese Month and that the Wisconsin Grilled Cheese Championships are next weekend in Dodgeville, we thought we'd devote this edition of Food Friday to the grilled cheese. Anna Thomas Bates is a writer and cheesemaker from Greene County. Her Tallgrass Kitchen columns appear in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's also won awards at the last four state grilled cheese championships. Her website is tallgrasskitchen.com, and she's co-owner of Landmark Creamery in Paoli. Anna, welcome back to the show. Anna, do we have you on the air?
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
Yep. Now, you've written that grilled cheese and tomato soup are your number one comfort food on a dreary day. What is it that makes that such a great conversation for those gray days?
You know, it comes back to, you know, when I was little and my mom would make the Campbell soup and, you know, American cheese on white bread. And since then, I have elevated all of those things a little bit, but they're still just warm and gooey. It's crunchy on the outside and just makes you feel better.
Now, I know you've written that you're willing to put other stuff in a grilled cheese sandwich, but it's got to feature the cheese. Why is that?
It's a grilled cheese sandwich. That's it. So, you know, if you put meat on, it should be a seasoning, a little bit of crumbled bacon, some really thinly sliced ham. But if you're putting a whole chicken breast on there, it is no longer a grilled cheese sandwich. It's a chicken sandwich with melted cheese.
Now, is there such a thing as a bad grilled cheese? It's pretty simple in its basic form. Is it possible to go horribly wrong?
You know, only if you kind of really aren't paying attention while you're cooking. But it's a pretty simple process. But as long as you get that cheese melted and you get the outside of the bread nice and crispy and you're using, you know, some fairly decent cheese, you're going to have a good experience.
As long as it's not on fire, it's going to be pretty good.
Yes.
All right. Now, that said, there are some techniques you've talked about. I think you've even said this on the air, the idea of using mayonnaise instead of butter on a grilled cheese.
You know, it's kind of hotly debated, and I have used both. If I have room temperature butter that's nice and spreadable, I will go for that. However, if you're really in a hurry, if you come home late at night on a Friday and you just really want a grilled cheese sandwich, mayo works pretty well. And it actually, the big benefit of mayo is that it doesn't burn quite as quickly as butter. So if you have a little trouble getting your cheese melted, that's the balance, getting your cheese melted and getting the outside cooked properly and not having one happen too quickly. So mayo is nice because it doesn't burn like butter. But if you're keeping a nice steady heat, you know, some great Wisconsin butter is going to make a really delicious sandwich.
Talk us through the basics of grilled cheese making technique.
Yeah, so I usually use, you know, room temperature butter, so it's nice and spreadable. I actually put it right on the bread. You can put a little bit in the pan if you want to get things going too, but having a nice layer on the bread, and I also use salted butter to add a little bit of seasoning there. If you have time, shredded cheese melts a little more quickly. So I put shredded cheese on the bread, put everything together. If I'm using any, you know, a little bit of jam or a little bit of mustard for flavor, I'll put that on, add on my cheese, and then kind of a nice medium heat. And then you're just watching getting that nice side, that first side of the bread nice and golden brown. Flip it over, and hopefully by the time the second side is finished, you've got nice melted cheese all the way through the middle.
In just a minute, we'll get to the big question, what kinds of cheese can we put in? But let's start with the outer. Well, we already did the very outer, the mayo or butter, the bread. What are you looking for in a good grilled cheese bread?
Well, in our shop, Landmark Creamery Provisions in Paoli, we use Madison sourdough bread. And we use that for a couple of different reasons. It's really well-made bread. It's a traditional fermented sourdough, so it's a little bit of tang. It's the right thickness. It's not too thick. It's a fairly thin bread, and it's fairly sturdy. And we find that if you freeze the bread first, it actually works a little bit better. If your bread is super fresh, it's going to be very soft. It's going to have a lot of moisture in it, and it's actually a little harder to get that butter spread and get it to crisp up really nicely.
So freezing it for, what, an hour or something, will that do the trick?
I usually just, what the grilled cheese we're using, or the bread we're using for the grilled cheese sandwiches, we keep in the freezer, we bring it out that morning. So it's thawed when we cook it, but it's been frozen.
Talking to Anna Thomas Bates on this edition of Food Friday. She's a repeat Grilled Cheese Championship Award winner. We're talking about the grilled cheese sandwich. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is the secret to your perfect grilled cheese sandwich? Anna, let's talk about cheese. The sky's the limit. We got a zillion to choose from. What are some of your favorite go-to cheeses or cheese combinations?
Yeah, the sky is the limit. And here in Wisconsin, we are very lucky to have world championship award-winning cheeses at our fingertips at almost every grocery store you can go to. Of course, since we make our own cheese at Landmark Creamery, we are a little partial to some of those. So we do a lot of sheep milk cheeses, and one of ours called Pipit, and another one, which is a pasture-grazed cow milk called Tallgrass Reserve, are two creamy cheeses that melt really well. But we have a lot of friends who make some really good cheese, too. So we love to use Hook's Cheddar. We love to use Pleasant Ridge Reserve from Uplands. We like Little Mountain from Raleigh's. And, of course, Marika Gouda. She has a whole bunch of really nicely melting Goudas as well.
If we're using a nice, sharp cheddar, what's a good cheese to pair with that if we want to start having a two or maybe even three cheese combo?
Yeah, if you're going to do a couple different cheeses, a nice way to go is to think of something that melts really nicely. So a younger cheddar, a Colby, or even a Munster, all of those are really creamy and they're going to be really, really meltable. And they'll have flavor, but then you can add in some harder cheeses like that Little Mountain from Raleigh's, like that Pleasant Ridge Reserve, that since they're kind of mountain-style cheeses, alpine-style cheeses, they don't melt in the same way as those younger cheeses, but they're very, very flavorful. So putting kind of those two together, something young and super creamy and melty and something that's older and a little bit more robustly flavored is a really good combination.
Now, we mentioned the State Grilled Cheese Championship is coming up. You've competed in those in the past and won awards in them. Is this pretty high pressure? There's a lot of people probably getting real creative with their grilled cheese at a contest like that.
It's a lot of fun, and they have a lot of different categories. So first they divide amateurs and professionals. And actually, the amateurs go a little bit more crazy. They've got garnishes and sauces and aiolis and all sorts of things. And then I usually compete with the professionals, which is a lot of local chefs. Students from the culinary schools compete, and it's a lot of fun. And then there's different categories. So there's just classic grilled cheese, which is just cheese, then classic plus one, where you can add up to one ingredient, and even as they go, allow you to add more and more ingredients in different categories, it still must be at least 60% cheese, and there they require that you use Wisconsin butter.
And you've got a couple of recipes you've shared with us. We have these up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's tackle one of them now. This is plus two, I guess. It's a Gruyere grilled cheese with mushrooms and honey chive butter. Talk about that flavor combo.
Yeah, so making a compound butter is a really easy way to add a lot of flavor but still keep a pretty simple grilled cheese sandwich. So that particular recipe, I used butter, let it come to room temperature, added in just a little bit of honey and then some nice fresh snipped chives. So you've got that nice allium flavor to balance with the sweetness. That gets spread on the outside of the bread. And then a nice mountain cheese, an alpine cheese like a Gruyere, a Comté style. Wisconsin, again, Pleasant Ridge Reserve would be a great one to use there. Is kind of what's in the middle. So those cheeses are really meaty and brothy and savory. So a little bit of sweetness and a little bit of onions and then the nice savory mushrooms. You kind of just have an umami bomb sandwich, but it's still pretty simple ingredients.
That's nice. A lot of us are going to have those chives popping up in our yards any minute now. We can just snip them right out there.
Yep, and they're growing out in my yard, so they should be coming up everywhere.
We are talking about grilled cheese on this edition of Food Friday. Anna Thomas Bates is with us, food writer and cheesemaker from Greene County, co-owner of Landmark Creamery in Paoli. She's won a few Wisconsin Grilled Cheese Championship awards along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your secret to an awesome grilled cheese sandwich? Do you like to keep it real simple or add some frippery along the way? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a couple recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking about how to make the best grilled cheese sandwiches. April is National Grilled Cheese Month for some reason, and next weekend is the Wisconsin Grilled Cheese Championships in Dodgeville. Anna Thomas Bates is with us. She's a writer and cheesemaker. She's won awards at least four state grilled cheese championships. Her Tallgrass Kitchen columns appear in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and her website is tallgrasskitchen.com. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What to you makes the perfect grilled cheese? What is your secret when cooking them? What do you like when you're eating them? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michelle is with us in Madison. Michelle, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to tell us about, Michelle?
My favorite grilled cheese combo is a cranberry walnut bread with a really sharp cheddar. The sweet of the cranberry just really plays against the sharpness of the cheddar cheese.
Okay, I'm with you on that point, Michelle, but the walnuts in the bread, is that, I don't know about the texture there.
It's good, it's good. You know, it's, the bread's already crispy because you're, you know, crisping it up with the butter, so it just adds a little extra crunch.
Okay, I hear you, Michelle. Thanks. Anna, what do you think?
Oh, I think it sounds delicious, and that's another great way to add flavor is if you have an interesting bread, and I love the idea of fruit and nuts in the bread because if you think about putting together a cheese board or a cheese platter, jams and dried fruits and nuts are all very common things that go really well with cheese, so why not put them all together in a sandwich?
Interesting. Michelle, thank you so much. Jennifer joins us now in Madison. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I'm really enjoying this. I love grilled cheese sandwiches. And a couple that I make that people really seem to enjoy, one is for dinner, and you would have it just with a light salad, using either white or whole wheat, but, you know, bakery bread or bread you've made yourself. And it has howdah or smoked howdah cheese, thin slices of apple, and a smear of mango chutney.
Ooh.
And if the chutney's too chunky, you have to chop it up first so it smears easily. But people seem to really love that. And sometimes, to make sure that one is totally cooked, I do it on a one of those grills that you have indoors where it's kind of like a panini press.
Uh-huh, or like the George Foreman grill, that kind of thing.
Right, right, that kind of thing. And then another one I make is similar in a way, but it's more of an appetizer. Using little pieces of baguette, you put a fig and walnut compote on one side and a meltable blue cheese on the other. Ooh. And quick put that together in a skillet. And it's just lovely.
Sounds fantastic, Jennifer. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And Anna, that reminds me of the other recipe you shared with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Grilled cheese. She had apple. You've got a grilled cheese and pear sandwich. Walk us through that one.
Yeah, well, very similar to what Jennifer said. That is a sandwich that has just a little bit of jam, some fig jam, and then some thinly sliced pear. But just like Jennifer uses, thinly sliced apples are really, really nice. They add a little bit of freshness, a little bit of crunch, and it's just a really simple way to add just a little something extra to your sandwich. And I love her idea of the fig and the blue cheese, and you could even add a little bit of prosciutto if you wanted just a little bit of saltiness, and that would be a really kind of nice little intensely flavored small sandwich appetizer bite, but it sounds really good.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Pamela on the line in Eau Claire. Pamela, hi.
Hello. I'm actually from Holman. I'm on my way back from Eau Claire.
Okay.
I like to use the Munster Swiss and cheddar cheese for the sandwich, and then I make a tomato basil soup when I add curry powder.
Curry powder in the tomato soup to go with that Munster Swiss and cheddar sandwich. Okay. This is a nice kind of a classic bunch of cheeses there, Anna.
Yeah, that's like an all-Wisconsin, really yummy, melty sandwich. It sounds great. And adding curry powder to the tomato soup sounds nice, too. Add just a little, elevate the spices and the flavors a little bit.
Yeah, that's. I like that kind of, okay, we're going kind of straightforward with the cheese there. Nothing too out there with flavor. But then we add a little zest in the soup side of the equation. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Pamela. We heard from Christina on Facebook who says grilled cheese and Spam sandwiches with her tomato soup. Okay, Spam on the grilled cheese. Have you done it, Anna?
I have not. I have not. But, yeah, you know, really whatever makes people happy, and I bet the nice saltiness of it probably goes well with the cheese.
All right, kind of thin, though, I think. Let's go back to our callers now. Richard is with us in Madison. Richard, hello.
Hello. Good afternoon.
What do you want to tell us about when it comes to the grilled cheese, Richard?
Yeah, of course. So I'm with you on the debate of what should be smeared on the outside of the bread. But one of the interesting life hacks, I guess, I could use is I like whenever I make bacon, I have like my own kind of collection of drippings. I like to make my own homemade lard. So I like smearing some like kind of my own bacon lard on top of like my bread to kind of use that on the outside of my bread. But I don't know how many people have their own homemade lard sitting at home. But it really adds a nice kind of extra touch of like smoky texture and flavor to the rest of the outside of the bread.
Richard, thank you so much, Richard. Yeah, I do, Anna, keep my bacon residue, the drippings there in the fridge. I'm the only one who likes it in my house. I make eggs with it. That's my big thing. What do you think of that idea, replacing the butter with the bacon fat?
I think it's great. I also have my own jar of bacon fat. And actually, for one of the sandwiches I won an award with, I did mix in a little bit of bacon fat with the butter. But yeah, you could go all bacon fat, too, and just have a really, you know, savory, savory sandwich. So I think it's great.
My worry, Anna, would be that you mix it with the butter, which sounds like a good idea, because I worry that the bacon flavor is just going to take over and drown out a cheese, unless it's a really strong flavored cheese.
Yeah, or that could kind of be if you were just using a really Colby or something that didn't have a lot of flavor, the bacon could be the flavor, and you'd be using the cheese for a great texture.
Richard, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Anna Thomas Bates is with us on Food Friday. We're cooking up some grilled cheese today. You can share your favorite grilled cheese, bread, and other combo. Except we heard John says anything other than bread, cheese, and your choice of fat to spread on the bread, butter, mayo, etc., is not a grilled cheese. That's all caps. Once you add anything else, it's no longer grilled cheese. It becomes a melt. Anyway, we have a thing in our house we make called melty sandwiches. It's just grilled cheese with lunch meat on it. But we don't call it a grilled cheese anymore. I guess we're purists, too. Anna, do you feel strongly about this?
Yeah, there's definitely people who are, once it's something other than cheese, it is a melt. I say as long as it's mostly cheese, I still will call it a grilled cheese, but I see everyone's point. So we're down to logistics and linguistics.
We'll go back to our callers now. Mike is with us in Appleton. Mike, hi.
Hey there, guys. How are you doing today?
Good. What's your grilled cheese secret, Mike?
First, I got to admit, when I heard grilled cheese is spam, my mind instantly went to Monty Python.
There's only one spam, not multiple spams in that one.
Exactly. But, my personal favorite one, the ingredients aren't exactly difficult, but due to the preparation is simple. Like I heard the one gal with the aioli and the chutney and what have you. Mine is just simply provolone cheese and dark rye bread. The secret is the fact that you have to be really careful watching that bread because you can't watch it toast. I mean, with a lighter bread, obviously it's very clear, but with it being that dark already, you have to go by feel, by smell, by texture, the whole schmear like that, just not to overcook it.
Mike, thanks a lot. That sounds great. Really simple. I mean, dark rye bread has a lot of great flavor. I love it. And I just like, I eat it with toast and some cheese on it. Provolone would be great. Dark rye and provolone is a really simple, straightforward grilled cheese, Anna.
Yeah, that sounds great. I would also try it with Swiss, and I'd probably be really tempted just to put a little bit of mustard on there, too.
Ooh, yeah, that's kind of a classic German open-faced sandwich, or I guess grilled cheese, not open-faced sandwich. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Tony joins us now from Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you got for us?
So my favorite grilled cheese always starts with my bread. I use Angelic Bakehouse sprouted grain breads. It adds like a very good unique texture and nutty flavor to the bread. Also I love using sharp cheddar and like some form of like sweet bacon jam or something. Makes it really good.
Sweet bacon jam. Okay, Tony, thanks a lot. So a sprouted grain bread from Angelic, he says. Anna, have you experimented with a lot of different kinds of bread? I know you like the sourdough in particular.
I mean, any of those well-made breads just make a really good foundation. Just a little bit sturdier, a little bit more flavor. You know, some of the just loaves you get from the grocery store off the shelf, they're so soft it's hard to spread the butter, and they just don't get quite as crispy. So I love that idea of using local bread and something that's just really well made. And bacon jam, I'm pretty sure in Tallgrass Kitchen, in one of my columns, I actually did a bacon jam, but you're also able to start, you're starting to find more products like that on the shelf as well. So I know from Imagination in Madison, I believe they have a bacon jam for sale. But yeah, it's kind of savory, kind of sweet, even a little bit of heat in there, but it's a nice addition too.
Tony, thanks for the call. So bacon jam, that's just a jam that's going to taste like bacon. It's that straightforward?
Yeah, it's got bacon in it, usually some onions. Some of them have coffee, a little bit of crushed red pepper, and then usually they have like brown sugar or maple syrup, so there's some sweetness to it. So it's a nice combo of sweet and salty. And you don't need very much. A little goes a long way.
Okay, we've talked about a lot of the permutations of grilled cheese. You mentioned doing it with a board with maybe nuts or dried fruit or things like that. What are some of your favorite things to drink? What's a good drink and grilled cheese pairing for you?
Oh, I never thought of that. But, you know, I think if it was evening, you'd have to just go with a nice Wisconsin beer. I love beer and cheese together. The bubbles, the effervescence from the beer kind of cleanses your palate between the bites because cheese is so nice and fatty, and you can find so many different flavors. So depending upon what cheese you are using, I'm sure you could find a really great Wisconsin beer to go with it.
And finally, Anna, if we're entertaining, would you say we're watching a Bucks game and we're having everybody over for the playoffs, what's a good way to serve up grilled cheese as our party treat?
Yeah, that gets a little, it depends on how many you can make at once. So, but if you got that bread, you know, if you could do kind of 4 or 5 and then just cut them into smaller pieces. But yeah, people are pretty happy when you have melted cheese on anything. So you could go simple or complicated. But yeah, it's a great party food.
Anna, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a good day.
That's Anna Thomas-Bates, writer and cheesemaker from Greene County. Her Tallgrass Kitchen columns appear in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's won awards at the last 4 Wisconsin Grilled Cheese Championships. We've been talking about how to make the perfect grilled cheese. 2 recipes from Anna at WPR.org/Food Friday, Gruyere grilled cheese with mushrooms and honey chive butter, and grilled cheese and pear sandwich. Try them out. Let us know what you think, or come up with your own invention this weekend and tell us about it on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The security of elections in the United States is in the spotlight again following the release of the widely anticipated redacted Mueller report. Mueller's investigation found that the Russian government actively tried to interfere with the 2016 presidential election, though there's no public evidence that says votes were changed as a result of hacking attempts. And the election interference in 2016 could play a significant role in the 2020 general election. Our next guest is here to talk about cybersecurity and how officials can safeguard future elections. Dave Schrader is a strategist and senior cyber subject matter expert at the UW-Madison. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, my pleasure.
Well, we've seen some of this information before, but the Mueller report sums up a lot of it. Can you give us an overview of what we know was targeted by Russians when it comes to actual hacking attempts and phishing attempts during the election campaign?
Sure. So, like you said, this is not all new information, but the special counsel's report really ties it all together. And so what we've seen is that there were 3 distinct elements of the Russian effort. One of them was the social media influence piece, which was undertaken by the Internet Research Agency. And then there was the hacking operations, which is was actually the phishing and the hacking of emails and documents that were leaked out via WikiLeaks and DC leaks and other avenues. And that was actually carried out by the a military intelligence component of Russia, the GRU. And then later on, there was a more conventional espionage operation where they were attempting to infiltrate and make contacts with people affiliated with the Trump campaign.
And that middle part, the phishing and hacking, of course, the Democratic emails were a big part of that. But also there were lots of attempts, it looks like, to gain access to things like county election officials and at least one company that makes voting machines. Can you talk about what we saw there?
Yeah, that's right. There were a number of efforts to gain access to various systems in different states around the country, down to the county level, anything from voter registration databases to websites where election results would be posted. And like you said, there was no evidence and no experts really believe that any votes were changed. But if you think about what the implications are for having a foreign government actually even targeting these systems in the first place, cast doubt over the entire process. And I think that a lot of those kind of efforts were designed to do just that. So they don't necessarily even have to be successful. They don't even have to intend to be successful to cast doubt on the process.
Now, when you look at our election system around the country, what do you see as maybe potential points of vulnerability?
Well, the good news for election systems across the U.S. is that they are so disparate, so distributed, down to the levels of individual counties. There are all sorts of different systems that are in use. There's paper systems, there's electronic systems, there's electronic systems with paper backups and scan systems, and the infrastructure for that is really, frankly, all over the place. So there isn't, really one easy way for any kind of attacker to target things wholesale. Because electronic voting systems are electronic, they're running software, like any system, they can be vulnerable to hacking. But we have enough backup systems in play with voter-verified paper audit trails and the ability to physically recount votes that the systems are fundamentally pretty safe. Now, when you see a lot of these voting villages and things that have been set up at hacking conferences and you talk about how people will break into these systems in a matter of minutes, that's not really something that you can do remotely. That's not something that people really have an opportunity to do at the polling place. But the thought that it's out there, the notion that a vulnerability exists, it can itself be damaging to trust in the process. So that's a theme that has been pushed by Russian trolls as well, kind of feeding into this idea that the entire system is vulnerable.
Talking to Dave Schrader, strategist and senior cyber subject matter expert at UW-Madison, about Russian attempts to gain access to voter information, a hack into county election officials, and more, all released in the Mueller report, and about the future of election security here in the United States. Dave, looking at solutions to make things as safe as possible when it comes to elections, you mentioned that paper trail. Now, as I understand it, given that we have different systems all over the country, there are some places that you end up with a paper and some places that you don't. Would you like to see some kind of paper trail left in every voting district?
Well, I think that just for the element of trust in the system, regardless of what type of system you're using, because of the kind of the sanctity of the vote, the idea of one person, one vote, and you want your vote to count, you want to be able to see that the vote that you've cast is properly reflected. And so if you're using an electronic system, which a lot of counties and states are interested in doing for the added benefits of ease of counting and administration and things of that nature, people still need to actually see that their vote was properly reflected. So depending on the system that's in use, a lot of times a voter is going to be able to actually look at a paper audit trail that would come into play with, if there was ever a need for a recount or an audit or spot audits of that process. So again, my judgment on the actual electronic voting systems, not the scan systems, but the ones where you're using a touchscreen and you're not actually, drawing an X or filling in a bubble or things of that nature, that it's more about trust in the process. And a lot of the efforts that the Russian government undertook starting as early as 2014, leading up to the 2016 election, was just to sow chaos and discord and doubt about our institutions, about the process, and about whether or not your vote even counts, or whether the votes could be altered.
But it sounds like you're saying maybe there's more chaos, more impression of chaos than reality of chaos. Things aren't as bad as they might appear.
I think that's exactly right. From a technical perspective, even though there are problems, there are vulnerabilities in these systems that are, in some cases theoretical, in some cases only able to be performed if someone actually has, an extended period of physical access to a system. I think that, we do need to make sure these systems are secure from a cybersecurity perspective. But the reality is that I think the concerns about a foreign actor actually coming in and targeting voting systems in a polling place, in a strategic county or district, those are a little bit overblown. But the idea that the fear is there is, in itself a problem. And, just last week, DHS and FBI came out with a joint intelligence bulletin where they said that election systems, not just voting machines, but parts of the election infrastructure, whether it is voter registration databases, websites, or other computer systems at the county government offices in all 50 states, were targeted in 2016.
I want to look at the human element, the person sitting in front of the computer. It seems like a common theme in efforts to gain access to whatever, somebody's emails, voting systems, corporate material for that matter, involves phishing, getting
That's
that person
right.
at the computer to open something that they shouldn't ought to open. Are there successful ways that people are out there training staff at all levels to not open that stuff?
Well, we try, and it's really a cat and mouse game. The fact of the matter is, a lot of government agencies, companies, different organizations, nonprofits, the security groups in these organizations will, have education campaigns for their users. They will send out, fake phishing emails to their staff to see how many people click on them and things like that. But today, I think a lot of people think about the more cloak and dagger aspect of hacking, but the way that a lot of these breaches occur, and this is exactly what we saw with Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016 and with John Podesta's email account, is that someone gets a phishing email that's crafted, customized, if you will, just for them. It looks legitimate. In the case of the Podesta fish, he even talked to one of his IT people and said, "Hey, I got this message to secure my Google account. Is this legitimate?" And they even said it was legitimate, and that was all that was needed to then get access to that account. And when people get access to accounts of more senior officials within an organization, they can then a lot of times use that access to move laterally and gain access to other systems. And so that is was kind of the genesis of what we saw for a lot of the leaks that came out email-wise in 2016. And that's still true today. People continue to click on these messages, and there's not really an easy way to tell an ordinary user of technology who's just trying to use the, email or websites to do their job, what exactly you should or shouldn't be clicking on. Because as soon as we tell someone only click on an email that has this little stamp here, or only click on something in an email that, is signed or comes from someone you trust, then, attackers will develop new techniques to game that as well. So it's a really vexing problem, and phishing and spear phishing in particular, which is targeting those kind of individualized emails at a single person in order to gain access, is really still one of the greatest cybersecurity threats.
We'll leave it there. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
Dave Schrader is a strategist and senior cyber subject matter expert at UW-Madison. He joined us today to talk about the security of our election system in light of the Mueller report and a look ahead at what could be done up to the 2020 election. One story out of Washington you may have missed recently amidst all the hubbub, the U.S. Department of the Interior has a new secretary, David Bernhardt. He was confirmed by the Senate last week, but just a few days later, the agency's watchdog announced an investigation into him over possible ethics concerns. The issue of possible conflicts did come up during Bernhardt's confirmation process. Here's Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon.
Mr. Bernhardt, I'm not claiming that you are Big Oil's guy. The big oil lobbyists are making that claim. Your former clients in the oil and gas industry have been caught on tape crowing about how you're their guy at Interior.
Emily Holden is a reporter covering the environment for The Guardian U.S. Emily, thanks for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, talk about David Bernhardt and his background a little bit before we get into this ethics investigation. What has he been doing before becoming Secretary of the Interior?
So David Bernhardt is sort of your quintessential Trump administration appointee before joining Interior as a deputy secretary, before he recently was confirmed as the overall Interior secretary. For years, for decades, he had worked in D.C. at a very influential law firm called Brownstein Hyatt, where he was a lobbyist for a lot of the same interests that he is charged with regulating now. So the oil and gas industry and also agribusiness and something called the Westlands Water District, which he has made some decisions on since entering his new position.
Now, what do we know about why the Inspector General at the Department of the Interior is opening this probe?
Well, we can't say specifically which of his potential conflicts they're investigating. It could be many. What we do know about Secretary Bernhardt is that he has so many clients that he's worked for previously. He actually carries a card around with him with a list so that he can remember which ones he is recused from speaking with alone. And so there are some really like specific requirements that he has to meet. So, for example, he could be at a conference where some of the companies that he's worked for are, but he can't meet alone with them on one issue that pertains just to them. So this Inspector General review, which is basically the internal watchdog for the department, could be looking at any of the many complaints that they have received from Democrats, from environmental advocacy groups, from open government groups about some of these meetings that he's had and some of the decisions that he's made that have seemed to benefit a lot of the companies that he has represented previously.
And remind us, let's look back at his predecessor, former Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Why did he leave the post?
Well, he had a lot of conflicts of his own, a lot of similar conflicts. And one was this very complicated issue of a casino decision that he seemed to stall for Indian American tribes to open a casino in Connecticut after a large lobbying effort from MGM. I recently wrote about Bernhardt's meetings that could have been about something similar, just revealing that he had been meeting with some of the same people, lawyers and lobbyists involved in that lobbying effort. And those are meetings that have been previously undisclosed. So now it looks like Bernhardt may have been making or involved in a lot of the decisions that had drawn scrutiny for Secretary Zinke as well.
Now, Bernhardt was confirmed recently by the U.S. Senate with a little bit of Democratic support. Mostly Democrats voted against him. Were a lot of these issues raised in that confirmation process?
Many of the ethics concerns were raised. It was very much assumed that he was going to be confirmed, particularly because he had some support unanimously from Republicans and from a few Democrats as well. One Democrat said, essentially, he wouldn't have been my pick, but we did lose the election, and it's better for my state to have an Interior Secretary in place so that if we have issues, there's someone we can pick up the phone and call. But Senator Ron Wyden did bring up a lot of his concerns about these ethical conflicts that he sees, and also about Secretary Bernhardt's record keeping. So this idea that he had basically these daily cards that he would keep that his staff would edit and then delete at the end of each day that would have more information about meetings that he had attended than his public records, his public calendars. And the Interior Department has just started to release those. And that's one of the reasons why we now know that he had meetings with people who may have been involved in this MGM lobbying effort.
And are these things being revealed now that weren't available in time for that Senate confirmation?
Some of them, yes. There is information that's continuing to come out. Some of it is coming out because of requests that he release that information. Some is coming out because of lawsuits over Freedom of Information Act requests. So requests for information that should be public, that the agency has been slow walking. That's been happening at many of the environmental agencies in the Trump administration.
We're talking to Emily Holden, a reporter covering the environment for The Guardian U.S., about David Bernhardt, the new Secretary of the Interior, and ethics complaints about him and an investigation by that department's Office of Inspector General. Emily, to talk about what's at stake here, can you give us an idea of the scope of things that the Department of the Interior is in charge of?
Sure. Just to talk about some of the decisions that Secretary Bernhardt has been involved in. So he's been very influential in his time as deputy before he became overall Interior Secretary. So we know that he helped to revise conservation plans for the greater sage grouse, which is this chicken-sized bird that lives across tens of millions of acres in the American West. And this decision would essentially allow for more oil and gas development in the critical habitat for the bird. We know that he has been working on the Trump administration's main priorities to expand oil and gas drilling and mining on federal lands and offshore. We know that he blocked the release of a scientific report that showed that three widely used pesticides could present risks to more than 1,000 imperiled species. And he's also been involved deeply in rolling back the standards for how the federal government protects the species that we know are in danger.
That offshore drilling issue you mentioned, I understand that was a big point of concern in the Senate confirmation hearings. Some Democrats in coastal states looking for assurances that he would allow states to set their own course when it came to offshore drilling. How did that all shake out in the confirmation?
Well, we know that the Interior Department is certainly moving forward, trying to expand drilling offshore, and that there's been some pushback from coastal states, including like Florida. But that hasn't been settled out completely yet.
Do we have a timeline for this ethics investigation from the department's Office of Investigations?
It could take months. Similar investigations that have happened at the Interior Department and at the Environmental Protection Agency for Scott Pruitt, who's also left his post, have taken many months. And it depends on really whether the IG breaks that report down into a couple different sections or they're trying to do something all at once. But there are a lot of specifics that they have to get right. There are people they have to interview and documents they have to request. So those things can really take quite some time.
And finally, have we heard a response from Bernhardt himself or the Department of the Interior about these accusations and about this ethics investigation?
Well, specifically for his involvement in a decision on the casino that has really plagued Zinke and followed him even after his departure. Interior staff said unequivocally he was not involved in this in any way. And that has tended to be what he has said about various ethics issues. He really sees his recusals as necessary, and he says that he will follow the law and he won't meet with people that he said that he won't in certain capacities. But he really feels like these recusals are handcuffing him and that his experience with all these companies is what makes him qualified to be in this job, and that he shouldn't be held back by some of these requirements.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Emily Holden, an environment reporter for The Guardian U.S. She was with us today to talk about the new U.S. Secretary of the Interior, David Bernhardt, and a recently opened Inspector General investigation into his conduct that started just a few days after his Senate confirmation hearing just a little while back. You can follow her reporting over at The Guardian U.S. and share your thoughts with us. Email ideas@WPR.org. It's Easter weekend and stores are jam-packed with seasonally themed candy, including lots and lots of jelly beans. And for younger listeners, the Easter Bunny may have a lot of jelly beans too. But you're wondering, what are people's favorite flavors of jelly bean? The folks at candystore.com have some answers to that question. They base their research on bulk candy sales and surveys of candy consumers. Before I share some of their results, let's just say there are a lot more kinds of jelly bean on the market than there were when I was a kid. You got a package of jelly beans. There was a limited mix of colors. The black ones tasted like licorice. The red ones tasted like decorative soap that people put in their bathroom and never used. And the rest tasted like chewy sugar. Now there are a zillion varieties, and you can mix and match to your heart's content. Nationwide, looking at the results now, the number one flavor was buttered popcorn. That I did not see when I was a kid. Followed by cinnamon, black licorice, there's a classic, and cherry. Here in Wisconsin, we have a different number one. This was number 5 nationwide. The number one flavor in Wisconsin of jelly bean is watermelon. We are with Oregon and Alabama on that one, by the way. I can't see the top 5 in Wisconsin. The candystore.com website just says state-by-state rankings, intro paragraph, insert data table here. So we'll have to wait for next Easter to solve that mystery of the top 5 favorite jelly beans in Wisconsin. Happy candy eating. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.